This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, identity theft is all too common. Some anonymous thief somehow acquires your credit card information and uses it to order a bunch of stuff online. At least that's how it happened when it happened to me. I then called the bank, explained the situation, and the charge was forgiven. And as far as I know, that was the end of it. I never found out who the thief was or might have happened to them, and frankly, I really don't care. I'm just glad I wasn't out $900. But what if the theft stayed hidden for decades, affected my social life, my credit score? And what if the person behind it was someone I loved, someone I thought I could trust? Today, we'll share the story of an Indiana woman who was the victim of identity theft long before the internet made it easy. She currently lives in South Dakota, where she's an associate professor of consumer affairs at South Dakota State University. And she's the author of The Less People Know About Us, A Mystery of Betrayal, Family Secrets, and Stolen Identity. And she joins us live. Axton Betts Hamilton, welcome to All In.
Well, it's nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
And if you have questions for Axton or you want to share your story of identity theft, you can do so on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. First of all, Axton, where did you grow up? In what part of the state does this all take place?
I grew up in Portland, Indiana, which is about 30 minutes northeast of Muncie, just a stone's throw away from the Ohio border.
And without revealing too much, namely the perpetrator, can you tell us when you first started to see signs of this identity theft?
Sure. Back in 1993, before identity theft was a household term, my parents' mail started going missing. So we had a mailbox out by the road, you know, as many people, in Indiana still do, and we just weren't getting our mail. And there were all sorts of pieces of mail going missing, like bills and my dad's farm magazines. And my mom said, well, someone must be driving down the road and just stopping by our mailbox in the middle of the day and taking the mail. And she then decided, well, the best way to deal with that is to not have our mail delivered to the house anymore, but rather have it delivered to a post office box. And the mail theft continued. And somewhere along the way in dealing with all of these mail problems, Mom said that it was caused by an identity thief, and that her identity and Dad's identity had been stolen.
And how old were you in 1993?
11.
11 years old. And there were some other strange things that happened. Utility companies started showing up to turn things off, which didn't seem right. Your parents made some new rules to protect you. What were you no longer allowed to do?
One hard and fast rule in our house growing up for me, and it's still somewhat in effect to this day, is don't answer the door even if you know who the person on the other side is. And that rule was enacted because the individual responsible for this was likely someone very close to us, because by this point, the person responsible seemed to know everything about us. In fact, at one point, my dad said, it's almost like they live with us. They know us so well. So we assumed that the individual responsible was either an extended family member or a family friend. And so they couldn't be trusted. We didn't socialize with them. We didn't call them up on the phone, in part because we didn't have a landline phone because of the identity theft. And we started to isolate ourselves as a form of self-protection.
And so this isolation, what was the scope of it? Did you no longer attend family functions? Was no one in your family involved in anything outside of your home, extracurricular or something like that?
Well, sort of. So there were things that I was still participating in school, and I was very involved in 4-H, and I talk about that quite a bit in the book. And so there were things that I was still doing that were productive. And that was something that my parents always stressed growing up, that, you know, you're more than welcome to participate in things, but they need to be productive. So I was still allowed to do those things. But in terms of just socializing with people and going and hanging out with friends and running around and having a good time as a teenager, those things didn't happen.
How did this affect your life before college? You write in the book that the big reveal that this was still affecting your life didn't come until college. You talked about how the rules were strict at your home because of this. But leading up to college, what else?
Well, you know, in college, or no, I shouldn't say in college, in high school, how it affected me was that I felt different. You know, I felt othered. And in trying to explain to, you know, kids I went to school with why they couldn't call us, I couldn't explain identity theft to them. People didn't know what identity theft was back then. It was easier to say that we were too poor to have a phone. You know, people understood that. They didn't understand identity theft. So at times I felt like I had to lie because I was explaining things and giving different reasons for why things were the way they were. And it made me feel very phony. And I guess overall, I felt different and I felt marked. And I didn't understand why my family was a target. You know, what made us so attractive to an identity thief, and why do we have to live this way? And, you know, what axe does someone have to grind with us? Those were questions that I never got the answers to growing up.
And now, despite all this, you graduated early from high school and you enrolled at Purdue. And a year or so in at Purdue, you got an apartment, but you had trouble getting the power in your name, the electricity. What happened next?
Well, I called the electric company to establish service, and they told me the date and time they would be there, and I thought everything was fine. And a few days later, they send me a letter in the mail saying that they needed a $100 deposit to turn on the service due to my credit score. And I thought it was because I didn't have one. I knew enough at 19 about credit to know that not having credit can be just as detrimental as having bad credit, so surely that's what it is. Not a big deal. And there was a number to call at the bottom of the letter for a copy of my credit report, and I called it out of curiosity because I'd never seen a credit report before, and I wanted to know what report this nameless, faceless credit bureau was keeping on me. And I called the number, I ordered it, and I didn't think about it again for another 6 weeks. And I sent the electric company the $100 and, you know, went about my life. And 6 weeks later, I remember getting off the city bus at my apartment complex in West Lafayette, and there was a large manila envelope sticking out of my mailbox. Now, that looks really official, and I don't want to deal with that. It's been a long day. And I walked over and grabbed the envelope out of the mailbox, and I saw it was from the credit reporting agency. It was really thick. And I thought to myself, credit reports must be really hard to read. They must come with a lot of disclosures and instructions, because I'm expecting a half a page for a credit report, name, address, couple of student loans, the end, because that's what should have been there. And I opened the credit report, or I opened the envelope, and I looked at the credit report, and I saw that credit reports are not difficult to read. They don't come with a lot of disclosures and instructions, but rather mine was 10 pages long, full of fraudulent credit card entries and associated collection agency entries that dated back to the time that my parents' identities had been stolen in 1993. So it could be assumed that the person responsible for their identity theft was also responsible for mine.
Yeah, so up until this point, you didn't really know. I mean, you knew that your family was a victim of identity theft. You didn't really know that you personally, yourself, were a victim.
Right, and I was so excited to go away to college thinking that I had escaped it, that I could watch mom and dad deal with it from afar and I could start my own life successfully and get on a good financial footing myself. And that bubble was very quickly burst the day I got my credit report.
And so a few years go by and the problems keep coming up back home. What were your parents dealing with?
Oh, they were dealing with credit card accounts and collection agencies calling them and court summonses. In fact, there was a court summons in my name for a collection account that was sent to them when I didn't even live there anymore. And due to some of the financial challenges and, you know, some of the things related to the identity theft, my parents actually moved. You know, there were many reasons why they moved, but the identity theft did play a role in that. And so they ended up moving to a smaller property and, you know, in part thinking that might help with some of the identity theft issues, you know, starting over, getting away from the neighborhood and, you know, the people who surrounded us, because we suspected some of them as well could be responsible for the identity theft. It seemed like a fresh start in a somewhat different place would be a good thing for a lot of reasons.
And while this is all happening, what is their financial life like? I mean, were they just in constant debt? Did they seem to be doing okay? How did they move through it?
Well, it oftentimes seemed to be a struggle, because one thing that Mom had said frequently was that there's not enough money for this and there's not enough money for that. And, you know, my parents had gone to, I should say Mom said she had gone to the police to report the identity theft, and she had contacted creditors to report the identity theft and utility companies, and they were working on it. You know, they were working on it. And there never really seemed to be much result from that, which of course was frustrating not only for them, but for me as well.
And we only have about a minute, but you enrolled in graduate school, and this is when your experience starts to kind of shape your career. What did you begin to study?
I was in the master's program in consumer sciences and retailing at Purdue, and I focused my master's research on how people perceive identity theft and how they were choosing to protect themselves from it.
We are with Axton Betts Hamilton. She's assistant professor of consumer affairs at South Dakota State University, and she's the author of The Less People Know About Us. When we come back, it gets stranger. Of course, you can share your own stories of identity theft, or if you have questions for Axton, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in about 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on identity theft, I want to tell you about yesterday's show. We talked with a pediatrician, a school nurse, and a high school principal about the growing problem of vaping in schools, specifically high schools and even middle schools. We talked about the different approaches to dealing with the problem, like traditional discipline versus addiction treatment and education. It was a very insightful conversation. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In. We're back with Axton Betts Hamilton. She's the author of The Less People Know About Us, a memoir about her experience as a childhood identity theft victim and how it helped shape her life and career. And of course, this all took place in Indiana. Southern Jay County is where she grew up, and she's now an associate professor of consumer affairs at South Dakota State University. As always, we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. Have you been a victim of identity theft? What happened? How'd you deal with it? And are you still dealing with it? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. So you, your experiences affected your kind of graduate path, and you earned your PhD from Iowa State in 2012, which was a big moment, of course. But the very same day, you got some really bad news. What happened?
I did. So the day that I officially received my doctorate from Iowa State was the day that my mom was diagnosed with Burkitt's lymphoblastic leukemia.
And this is a treatable cancer. I think it has an 80% survival rate.
Yes.
But she was in the other 20%, it seems.
Correct.
As it turned out. How close were you with your mom?
I was close with her. I talked with her every day, sometimes multiple times a day, to tell her what I was working on in grad school and the research that I was working on related to identity theft, and you know how what I was learning was going to help others and also help hopefully solve our own case. And you know that, and just you know the daily nitty gritty of life in graduate school and then as a new professor.
And do you remember how she reacted to those conversations? Was she supportive? Was she closed off?
Absolutely, she was supportive. You know, one thing that she used to tell me was that Dad and I took the identity theft too personally. She was always very stoic and seemed very rational and at times void of emotion, whereas, you know, Dad and I are, you know, a little bit more reactive and, you know, definitely more so than Mom was. Mom always seemed like the rock. And, you know, even when she had cancer, it never seemed to ruffle her feathers. Dad and I were falling apart, but she did not get her feathers ruffled at all over her cancer diagnosis or going through chemotherapy and radiation. Didn't faze her one bit. Seemed tough as nails.
And so she was diagnosed in early August 2012. She lived about 6 months. And shortly after she passed away, your dad called up and he was mad. What was this about?
Oh, he was furious with me. So this happened 13 days after my mom passed away. And Dad was going through a file box in an outbuilding on their property. And he found a credit card statement in my name in that file box. And he called me and he says, "What were you doing running a credit card over limit in 2001? And I said, "What are you talking about? I didn't." And he said, "Don't you lie to me. I have the credit card statement in my hand." And I said, "Wait a minute, what credit card is it?" And he said, "Well, it's First USA. And I said, "Dad, that was one of the credit cards that was taken out in my name as part of the identity theft. What's Mom doing with that?" And he said, "Well, I don't know, but it's in here in a file folder with your birth certificate." And that's when my blood ran cold, because I had my birth certificate. And what logical explanation is there for a credit card statement that was taken out as part of my identity theft? What does that have any business doing in a file folder with my birth certificate in my mom's possession? And for her to never tell me about it? There's only one logical explanation, and that's that, you know, she was involved.
So this is where you start to put everything together. Were you on the phone with your dad when this realization hit, and did it hit him as well?
I was on the phone with Dad when this realization hit, and I said, "Dad, she was responsible. She was the one who perpetrated the identity theft." And this is 2013. So this had been going on since 1993. So I said to Dad, "Mom is responsible for how we've had to live for the past 20 years. And Dad said, "Oh, surely there's got to be some other explanation for this." He didn't want to believe that his wife, who had just passed away, that he had spent 46 years with, could be capable of doing something like this. And, you know, Dad was still continuing to sort through things. And I said to Dad, "You know, stop throwing things away. And anything you find related to finances that just doesn't quite make sense, set it aside, and I'll look at it when I come home over spring break in 2 weeks." And by the time spring break rolled around, there's a workbench in this outbuilding, and there was a pile of paper mounded up on this workbench of documents that Dad had found that didn't make sense. You know, some of them were collection agency notices. Some were for bank accounts in other states where Mom had tried to open bank accounts in his name and her name, and the accounts were rejected. There were documents that had variations of my Social Security number as well as his on them. You know, one document that comes to mind is a life insurance policy that we found out was never paid for, but our Social Security numbers on that document were different. There were pay stubs in her maiden name. There was just a lot just in that one outbuilding on our property.
And all the while, this is very shortly after she died. That had to have really messed up the grieving process for the two of you.
Oh, absolutely. So the first 13 days that she had passed away, we were grieving normally. And at least I consider it normal. And once we found out that Mom was the perpetrator, the grieving stopped for both
just
me and
flat
for Dad.
Stopped.
Oh, absolutely. And I've been asked about that so much over the years. And the best way I can explain it is, how can you grieve for someone that you clearly didn't know?
Yeah. Do you remember her at all attempting to warn you or talk with you about this before she died or anything like that whatsoever?
No. There was no indication on her deathbed that we were going to find anything at all, and certainly nothing of the magnitude that we found. And in fact, right before she was diagnosed with cancer, I received a national award for my child identity theft research and outreach. And the award was presented in Indianapolis. And Mom and Dad came down to the ceremony, and there's a photo of the three of us with me holding my award. Mom is smiling in that picture. You know, at that time, she would have known that she was the one responsible for the identity theft. She's smiling from ear to ear. She looks like a proud mom. There's no hint of guilt on her face whatsoever. I actually had that photo blown up and put in her hospital room at IU Med Center when she was receiving inpatient chemo. She stared at that picture every day and never, ever, ever gave an indication that she was responsible.
And we have that photo, and we're going to share that on social media if we haven't already. And she had to have known that this would all be found out when she was gone. Why do you think she never brought it up?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time thinking about that and researching different psychological disorders that have lack of guilt as a core feature. And I talk about psychopathy in my book as a likely explanation for why she did the things she did. Psychopathy in the DSM-5, which is essentially the Bible of psychological disorders that clinicians use, psychopathy is under antisocial personality disorder. So technically, I think Mom probably had antisocial personality disorder because she lacked guilt, and that's a core feature of antisocial personality disorder. Those who have antisocial personality disorder are very good at lying. They do it frequently. They're highly intelligent. Mom was highly intelligent. She had a bachelor's degree in finance. She worked a variety of professional jobs, in the finance industry as well as in the Indianapolis media. Highly intelligent. And those with antisocial personality disorder know the difference between right and wrong. On a cognitive level, on an emotional level, they don't care. And that would explain why Mom didn't say anything to us. She knew what she did was wrong, but on an emotional level, she didn't care.
Have you gotten anywhere close to estimating the total amount of money that she managed to get over the decades that she was doing this?
It's estimated to be $600,000.
And what was she spending it on? Why'd she feel like she needed it?
I wish I knew. And that would provide so much insight into what she valued and, you know, what was going on in her mind at that time. She cashed out a retirement account from her time working at a radio station in Indianapolis. And she was not near retirement age when she did this. So she didn't roll over the account into another retirement account. She cashed it out. That was tens of thousands of dollars. It's disappeared. She made a lot of money just vanish into thin air. And I've had a lot of folks ask me, well, surely you saw things around the house that would account for this amount of money. And we didn't. When she passed away, she was driving a 1999 Lincoln Town Car. So she wasn't driving new cars. I talk in the book about her buying shoes, but she bought them at Payless Shoe Source. She wasn't buying high-end shoes. She wasn't buying high-end purses. You know, she liked to shop at Payless Shoe Source and Target. That doesn't account for $600,000, over 20 years.
I think now is a good time to reveal that I actually worked with your mother. She worked at a radio station in Indianapolis for a time. I was hired there in 2005. She left in 2007. And I always remembered, and that's why I wanted to talk with you today, I always remembered her as being a really boisterous personality, kind of a brassy person. And I liked her, to be frank. But there were a lot of those kinds of people who work in radio, so it kind of seemed normal. But as I understand it, she wasn't the same around everyone. Can you talk about the ways her personality would change among different groups?
Oh, absolutely. So I've spent a lot of time over the past almost 7 years talking with people who knew her in different realms. So I got into her Facebook account and realized that she was conversing with a lot of people that she graduated high school with in Ohio. And I went to her 40th class reunion / alumni banquet in 2014. And the people in attendance there weren't convinced initially that I was her daughter because she said to them that she never had children. She also said that she was divorced. She said that my dad was beating her. She told people in different groups that my dad was beating her. She told friends of hers in Jay County that she and dad were divorced, and then they got back together, and then they were legally separated and divorced and back together. So, you know, those people think that mom and dad have been divorced and remarried several times, which is not true. And in different groups of people, she could be, as you're saying, very boisterous, very loud, and you know, nothing was off limits. No topic whatsoever was off limits, depending on who she was around. Other times she would be very quiet, almost brooding.
And you talked about psychopathy. Obviously, we can't diagnose without her here. You also talk about dissociative identity disorder and things like that. Can you attribute that kind of behavior to these sorts of disorders, or perhaps anything else psychologically?
You know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and yeah, you know, friends from her high school years have said, "Well, maybe she was depressed." This goes beyond depression. You know, whatever was going on with her was something extremely severe, and yet something that she could be a chameleon about and hide from so many different groups of people. And what's amazing is that she never made a misstep. Over 20 years, she never said the wrong thing to the wrong person to, you know, bring the dirty curtain down, so to speak.
And she obviously handled the finances in your family. She was in financial services. She was a stockbroker as well. And that was how she was able to keep all of this secret for so long, or at least contributed to it. She also handled the tax preparation for your family. What did you find out about that?
Oh, that was a extreme mess that we discovered shortly after Mom passed away. So Mom passed away in February, and she spent most of her career as a tax preparer, so she always did Mom and Dad's income taxes. And Dad trusted her to do that. And, you know, he was very concerned after she passed away regarding now who's going to do the taxes. Well, he found someone to do his taxes, and he sat down with her. And this was about a month or so after Mom had passed away. And she said, "I'm sorry, sir, I can't help you. You haven't paid taxes for the majority of the past 13 years. And that was a shock to Dad. And, you know, this was around that spring break time where I'd found all of those, or I had gone through all of those documents out on the workbench on my parents' property. And that week we also went to the UPS store in Muncie where Mom had a mailbox that we hadn't known about. And that's where all of the letters from the IRS were going.
Wow.
The IRS, when Dad and I went and got into that mailbox, there were a number of certified letters from the IRS, and the most recent one said, "We're ready to take your house." So at that time, Mom had just died. We just found out that she had stolen our identity and had essentially gotten away with it for 20 years. And on top of that, the IRS was ready to take the house.
And was that letter dated recently, or had it been in there for quite a while and you just hadn't heard the end of it?
It was pretty recent because, you know, those letters had been piling up while Mom had been sick and she got to the point where she couldn't drive anymore. And, of course, we didn't know the mailbox existed, so we weren't checking it. But we very quickly found a tax attorney, and it was a challenge to successfully settle the case, but we did. And one of the contributing factors to settling the case in our favor to where Dad could keep the house was that I could demonstrate that Mom had been forging Dad's signature on the tax returns. Because I had several documents where she had forged his name and didn't even try to match his signature at all. It looked exactly like Mom's handwriting.
We're with Axton Betts Hamilton. She's the author of The Less People Know About Us, A Mystery of Betrayal, Family Secrets, and Stolen Identity. And there's still plenty to talk about, including the present-day repercussions of her mother's actions. And she'll also share advice for people who are or will become victims of identity theft. As you might imagine, she's become quite an expert on the topic since all this came to light. And of course, your questions and comments are always welcome. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We'll do our best to get them in front of Axton before the end of the hour. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now with Axton Betts Hamilton. She's the author of The Less People Know About Us, a memoir about her experience as the victim of childhood identity theft perpetrated by her own mother over decades while she was growing up in East Central Indiana. She's also an associate professor of consumer affairs at South Dakota State University and now specializes in child identity theft, familial financial abuse, and elder financial exploitation. Again, if you have questions or comments for Axton, perhaps you have a story of your own, or maybe you need advice dealing with a similar situation, send them our way. We're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. Axton, I first became aware of this story when my old boss called me up out of the blue one day. And again, I worked with your mother when she was working at a radio station here in Indianapolis. And he and a coworker actually rescued a cat from the dumpster at the radio station or something like that. And your mom adopted it and named it after him. He called to tell me the story and that you had reached out to him and a few other former coworkers of your mother to get some information. What kinds of things did you hear from them?
Well, one thing I asked was, because, you know, Mom had been saying to so many people that she was divorced, I wanted to know what version of herself she was portraying to folks at the radio station. So I did learn that she was telling people that she was married and that I existed. I did learn that she seldom talked about my dad and seemed to talk about me in the context of being a shiny thing to show off. You know, she would talk about me at Purdue and talk about me going on to graduate school at Iowa State. And I was an object, I think, to be shown off. I did learn that on one level, people liked Mom. They thought she was funny. They thought she was fun. But at the same time, that funny, fun, outgoing, exaggerated personality, from their perspective, seemed like it might be a front for something that she was trying to cover up or hide from her coworkers.
And we've talked about dissociative identity disorder, and you write that when people have that, it's brought about through problems stemming from childhood abuse. And again, we can't diagnose her. She's gone. But you've written that that could have been an issue that she suffered from. Did you find anything that pointed to that, any childhood abuse or any reasons why this might have shaped the person who she was?
No. And unfortunately, on my mom's side of the family, there just aren't that many of us left. There's me and a cousin and my mom's much older half-brother. And that's the entire family tree that's left on Mom's side. I can say from my own experience with my grandfather, so her father, he never would have laid a hand on anybody. You know, he was very diplomatic, always very concerned with doing the right thing, being a source of support. With her mother, see, I never knew her mother. She passed away from cancer 4 years before I was born. I have learned from my dad's side of the family and from some other folks that my grandma wasn't necessarily the nicest person to him, and that she had some issues with compulsive shopping to the point that my grandfather at one point was seriously considering filing bankruptcy.
Wow. And okay, so if she suffered from dissociative identity disorder or psychopathy or things like that, and we can never really know for sure, but if she did, does that to you somehow give her a pass in your mind? Does that generate any sympathy from you?
I wish I could say that it did, but it doesn't, because she saw the effects of identity theft on Dad and on me for 20 years. She saw how that affected my ability to get a car loan and what an ordeal that was, and that the APR on that loan was 18.23%. She saw me struggle with getting utilities established at different apartments as I was going through college and then grad school. She saw how this affected me. She, if she had any twinge of humanity or guilt, she would have stopped. She saw it was hurting me, and yet she continued to choose to do what she was doing. And there needs to be accountability for that. And unfortunately, I can't hold her accountable through the justice system. If she were still alive, I would. So my way of holding her accountable while helping other people is to continue on with my career, as well as having written the book that I've written, to share my experience with others in the hopes that other victims can at least know that they're not alone. You know, my book's not a how-to recover guide. It's more of a memoir of my experience, so other victims out there know that someone else has walked in their shoes and come out the other side of it reasonably successful.
What about your dad? How has he dealt with this?
Well, funny thing, I talk about this in the book. A lot of people are surprised by this. One of the things that my mom had always promised Dad was that once she finally got that good paying job that she had always been striving for, she would buy him a Harley Davidson. And shortly after Mom passed away, Dad had a customer come into his store who had been diagnosed with cancer, and it was a terminal diagnosis. He and Dad talked to each other at the store quite a bit whenever this customer would come in. He knew what Dad had gone through and was going through. And he said, you know what, I'll sell you my bike at, you know, X dollar amount. And it took all that Dad had to be able to buy the bike, but it was actually the best thing for him. You know, he at the time was thinking, oh, this is a really dumb idea. I don't even know if I'm going to have a roof over my head. And here I am buying a bike. And I told Dad, this might be the best thing for you mentally. And it has been. So it's a custom Harley. It is built for speed. And, you know, Dad takes it around to different bike shows and goes to concerts at the different Harley shops. And, you know, he's meeting different groups of people who didn't know Mom, and, you know, he's enjoying life. And if you were to talk to him, he would say he's happier now than he's ever been.
We're hearing from listeners on Facebook. Mary writes, could gambling have been where all the money went to? It's common with people who have lots of money to pass lots of money pass through their hands without anyone else knowing. It disappears quickly. Do you think she had a gambling habit?
Well, I looked into that. So I looked into her possibly having an online gambling problem, or, you know, maybe she was going to Hoosier Park in Anderson, you know, right down the road, maybe passing by there on the way back and forth to Indianapolis after her, you know, her work at the radio station. So I was looking for receipts. I was looking for evidence in her computer of gambling. I went through every document, every email on her computer. I went through every scrap of paper that she had, even in her car, looking at every receipt. And there's no evidence of gambling addiction, and there's no evidence of drug addiction either. The medications I found in her possession were expired antibiotics.
Are you still uncovering anything strange? Has anything else cropped up since the book came out?
Nothing super strange. People have come forward to say that they aren't surprised that my mom did what she did to, me and my dad and my grandfather as well. We haven't talked about that, but she stole my grandfather's identity, so her father-in-law. Mm. So people have said, I thought there was something odd about her, and I could never put my finger on it, but nothing earth-shattering like what she spent the money on. That's something I would really like to know. I don't think there's a pot of money buried somewhere. I think it's been spent. I would like to know what it was spent on, just for the purpose of better understanding who she was and what motivated her.
Does this continue to affect your financial life today, or has all that been worked out?
It's still affecting my financial life, because one of the things that Mom did while I was an undergraduate at Purdue was she told me that she and Dad could afford my tuition, but not my housing. So I would have to take out loans for my housing, which was about $8,000 a semester at that time. Tuition was around $3,000. So Mom was giving me $3,000 a semester, and I was taking out loans for $8,000 a semester. After she passed away, we were talking about Mom's student loans, Dad and I were, because she was in graduate school at the time she passed away and had loans, and Dad wasn't really sure how to handle those and what the process was. And we got to talking about my student loan debt, and he asked me how much I had, and I told him, and he said, "Well, that's impossible. We paid for your college." And I said, "No, you didn't." And he said, "Yes, we did." And it hit me before it hit him what had happened. And I asked Dad, "How much money were you giving Mom a semester for my college?" And he said $11,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And she was only giving me three. So I'm still paying that student loan debt.
What about what this has shown you about your own personality? You are her daughter, so you are of her. Has this made you think twice about your own decision-making? I feel like I would be second-guessing my moral judgment a lot more after something like this.
I totally went through that right after she passed away. I actually went to my doctor and said, "Is there any way that I could turn out like Mom? Am I a time bomb here waiting to start doing this to, my now husband and other people?" And my doctor said, "No, because people who have psychopathy or antisocial personality disorder don't feel anxious." I've been diagnosed with an anxiety disorder since I was 14. So I take some comfort in knowing that if, by one metric of having an anxiety disorder, if that keeps me from one day behaving like Mom, then I guess I'm glad to have an anxiety disorder. Anybody who knows my dad and knows me will say that I act just like Dad. And even Mom would say that. And she would actually cry about that, that I acted just like Dad, but I look like her. And I look so much like her that on the cover of the book, there's a picture of my mom holding me as a baby. A lot of people who, like here in South Dakota, who know me but didn't know Mom, they look at the cover of the book and ask me, "Whose baby are you holding?" Because I look so much like Mom.
We're with Axton Betts Hamilton. She's the author of The Less People Know About Us, a memoir about her experience as the victim of childhood identity theft. She's now an expert on child identity theft, familial financial abuse, and elder financial exploitation. So let's move then from your story to your work. You're now considered an expert on these topics. If one suspects that this might be going on in their own family, what are some of the red flags they need to keep an eye out for?
Well, if you're concerned that a family member is doing this to you, you need to get access to your financial records. That's something that I didn't have growing up. That's something that Dad didn't have either, despite the fact that Dad would ask for financial records and Mom would say, "Oh, you don't trust me. And, I'm taking care of it," when she really wasn't. No matter what, always you know, see your financial records, be aware of what's going on with your existing accounts. If you are concerned that new accounts are being opened in your name, say you're getting bills for accounts that aren't yours, you're getting collection agency notices for accounts that you didn't open, get copies of your credit reports on annualcreditreport.com. That is a free website that was established by federal legislation back in 2005 that will allow you to obtain a copy of your credit report from each of the three credit bureaus for free. And then you can see what information is there. You want to pay attention to all of the accounts in your name to make sure that they are indeed truly your accounts. You're also going to want to pay attention to the addresses that are listed on your credit report, as well as the aliases listed on your credit report. So those are variations of your name that are used to obtain credit. So if there's information there that you know is not you, then you need to dispute that information with the credit reporting agencies.
And there are a number of services out there that claim to help prevent identity theft, or at the very least inform the consumer of any breaches to their accounts. What do people need to know about the best ways to prevent identity theft?
Sure. So, you know, there are a lot of services out there. I would caution you to read the fine print. Some will do more to help you than others. You know, some are very proactive. Some are very reactive, where they won't help you until identity theft occurs. You know, maybe they'll reimburse you for expenses for, you know, mailing documents via certified mail to original creditors and things of that nature. So read the fine print carefully. Cheapest is not always the best. And, you know, good ways to protect yourself, minimize what you put on social media. A lot of folks I see on Facebook are putting their full birth date. Don't put that out there. That's a piece of information that people can use to open accounts in your name. You know, there are three keys to your identity: your mother's maiden name, your date of birth, and your social security number. So many people are giving away one of those keys on Facebook. Monitor your online bank accounts regularly. You know, keep track of, you know, the mail that's coming into your house. If there are pieces of mail for accounts that you're not familiar with, don't just ignore it thinking it's a mistake. You want to follow up with that. Any bank statements or account statements that arrive, look at the fine print. And, you know, when you see errors, don't just ignore it and think it will go away. Follow up with the banks and the creditors promptly.
Down to about 30 seconds. But if you're a victim of identity theft and it's sort of significant enough to have been going on an awful long time, like yours did, enough to involve collection agencies sending letters, et cetera, how can a victim deal with them? What would they say?
Oh, well, one of the things that I would do, you know, in a case that is as, you know, prolonged and severe as mine, I would enlist the help of the Identity Theft Resource Center. They are a free service to all identity theft victims because these cases can get complicated. They can involve government benefits fraud. They can involve utilities fraud and credit fraud and just all kinds of things. And, you know, even employment fraud. People are using Social Security numbers to obtain employment. So get their help to help resolve complicated cases.
She's an expert on child identity theft and familial financial abuse, and she's the author of the memoir, The Less People Know About Us, A Mystery of Betrayal, Family Secrets, and Stolen Identity. Axton Betts Hamilton, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Subscribe to the podcast so you always know what we're talking about. And, of course, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.